or dealing with a hierarchy problem. So maybe extra dimensions, the fact that there are more dimensions of space-time and those are compactified, those are the reason why the electroweak scale is so small as compared with the Planck scale. I also told you that extra dimensions are also useful as a tool to describe strong interactions. So even if you don't believe on real extra dimensions, studying them is useful sometimes for studying duals of strongly coupled systems. I also told you that extra dimensional theories as a quantum field theory lack renormalizability. And unless obviously they are a string theory or they are highly supersymmetric. And I told you that the reason is that whenever you write an interaction like a quartic or even the gauge coupling in, let's say, five dimensions, or a quartic in five dimensions, you get that these guys have negative mass dimensions. What it means is that wherever you do a scattering process with this, any of these couplings involved in this scattering, you are going to have a cutoff from where you lose perturbativity, so your natural cutoff for your theory is going to be precisely, for example, in this case, lambda phi d, so lambda n dimensions, n plus 4, to the minus n. Essentially, the couplings that were dimensionless in four dimensions, they become dimensionful in five dimensions or more than four dimensions. And writing them down is like writing a mass term in your Lagrangian. It adds a scale to your physics. But this scale is precisely telling you where your theory is going to lose control when you write your probability is going to be proportional to, for example, it could be, lambda times the energy let me just get the, yes. So you will get the probability is lambda square, and then you get the energy to n. So the moment at which this probability is order 1, and anything beyond that will be above 1, then you set your cutoff for your theory. You don't rely on your theory anymore. So what you are doing is an effective theory that is an effective theory such as chiral perturbation theory. And this, what you do is to expand in powers of energy over your lambda new physics or lambda cutoff to some powers. So in chiral perturbation theory, you will expand in momentum divided by lambda QCD, the scale at which you expect your effects of QCD that are not related to chiral, to the chiral symmetry to, you know, become important. Same here. Your theory is an effective theory, has a validity, you know where the validity is. You look at all the dimensionful constants in your theory, and then you just, the lowest of all these cutoffs will be the cutoff of your theory. And then your theory, it has to be dealt as an effective theory with an expansion of energy over the cutoff to some power. Yes?
Small lambda has dimension minus n, right?
Let me come, because that's why I was a bit confused. We obtained it yesterday, yes. Yes, small lambda has dimensions of minus n.
So lambda, and big lambda cutoff is dimension of energy?
Yes. Yes, so probably good. Well, let me write this properly. So lambda has dimensions of minus n. This is dimensionless. So lambda times And energy is dimensionless. So when this becomes order one, is where I worry. So my cutoff is going to go as 1 over lambda. Is that okay? Good. All right, so yesterday we wrote down the scalar theory in extra dimensions, and we started talking about what to do with it. One of the things is that because you get extra boundary terms, and now you cannot assume the your extra dimension is finite, it's an interval, so you cannot just say, okay, my field just vanishes at infinity.
So that's a big lambda to the power of n, right?
Let me see. Sorry, I need more coffee this morning. Okay, so lambda is to minus n to the power of n, yes. Oh my God. Would that do? Yes, thanks. I'm always thinking in 5 dimensions. Cool. So we were discussing the appearance of these boundary terms, and that's why you end up choosing these boundary conditions. And the regular choices, the ones that most of the people use, are Neumann. Oopa. Those are the derivative of the field at the boundary. Is 0, and these I call plus boundary conditions, and then we also talk about Dirichlet, which is the field itself is 0 at the boundaries, and this is a minus boundary condition. Okay, so now we are going to look to the solutions of a scalar field in extra dimensions, where one of the dimensions is compactified. So it's, let's do 4D plus one extra dimension, we call it Z, and we say that Z goes from 0 to some length L. And what we obtained yesterday is that the action contained the volume integration and then something that looked like a minus dm, dm phi minus dv d phi, delta phi, plus boundary. This is the guys that are going to vanish because we are going to choose proper boundary conditions. So the equation of motion in extra dimensions is going to be precisely this equals 0. So what are the equations of motion? We are going to assume a couple of things because for simplicity and because the results are more or less, the main results are independent of these assumptions. We assume flat extra dimensions. And second thing we assume is that the potential is 0. So we are just going to look at the kinetic terms. So the equations of motion are, I don't need a minus sign, which is the operator in 4 dimensions minus derivative second respect to z over your field equals 0. So this equation of motion for the field in the extra dimension is separating the 4 dimensional part and the z part. There is no mixed terms, right? So that's an easy equation to solve. We assume what is called the Kaluza-Klein decomposition. The idea is that we are going to assume that our field that depends on x and z is going to be a sum over an infinite number of terms from n equals 0 to infinity of some 4 dimensional fields times a wave function in the extra dimension. So this is called the wave function. So you have to read this expression as I'm going to, this is a big field in five dimensions, let's say. And I say that my large field can be separated in an infinite amount of four-dimensional fields. But what I do is that this every four-dimensional field has some profile into the extra dimension, some wave function, or some profile. That's my assumption, it's separation of variables. Yes?
So why is the sum taken from 0 to infinity, but not from minus infinity to plus?
You can define your Kaluza-Klein expansion the way you want. Yes, you could do that. I'm doing it like this. OK, so this is the way I'm writing my field. I go back and put it here, and then I get, OK. So this operator is going to be acting only on the four-dimensional part, right? So I can pull out the wave function. And then the derivative, sorry, I should. Now I get phi of n of x, and the derivative working only on the wave function. So that's my bulk equation of motion. I'm telling you lots of new language. I'm not sure that you are, you heard these things before, this profile, wave function, bulk. That's the bulk of the extra dimension. Bulk just means anything that has to do with all the extra dimensions. And bulk is as opposed to boundary. Boundary are effects that are related only to the boundaries of the compactified extra dimension. So my bulk equation of motion is this one. What I'm going to do is to say that my phi of x, my four-dimensional excitation, is going to be a massive particle with mass that I would label mn. Just as, this is just a label so far. Why? Because I want my four-dimensional field to have regular, usual equations of motion. It's a scalar, so I want my 4D field, phi n of x, to have an equation of motion that looks like 4D phi of n equals mn squared phi of n. That's this statement. Phi of n is a massive four-dimensional scalar with mass mn. And writing it down, this is the equation you expect, the Klein-Gordon equation. OK, so you plug this equation back in the bulk equation of motion. And there, I just put the mass. So I'm going to get, let me just write everything explicitly. So now we have an expression that the operators are just acting on the wave function. So we can go and do this. As long as the field is non-zero, I can do that. And then I'm going to get an equation that looks like remember, this is us saying that the momentum in the fifth dimension goes as mn squared. for the mode n. Okay. So are we done? No, because we haven't obtained yet what is the value of the profile. To obtain the value of the profile, we had to solve this second order differential equation, where mn is, for the moment, an unknown. But we have two boundary conditions, right? We have the boundary conditions in each side of the interval. So with the equations of motion plus the boundary conditions, we are going to solve where is the value of fn, and also we are going to obtain where is the value of mn. Something I should tell you before, is that when I do this, and I'm saying phi n is a massive particle in four dimensions, I also want this guy to be canonically normalized. Or in other words, I want to obtain, when I look at the Lagrangian and I look at the kinetic terms, I want to get a normal, regular kinetic term for this phi n with the correct sign in front and the correct number in front. So the way to do that is to also impose that these wave functions are orthonormal. So this is, this is from 0 to n. Why do they have to be orthogonal? It's just because we don't want to obtain kinetic terms that are mixing different modes. And the normalization, the number here in front, is chosen such as at the end of the day, we will get a bunch of kinetic terms, like for phi n, d phi n, and we want the correct number in front there. So we want these guys canonically normalized, and we don't want these guys to mix with each other through kinetic terms. That's what this condition is achieving. All right. So let's go and try to solve this. It's a second order differential equation, but it's pretty simple. What it's doing is taking the second derivative and going back to the same function. So obviously this guy, fn of z, is going to be a linear combination of, for example, cosinus of, in this case, mnz, plus b sinus of mnz. Yes?
Should there be a minus sign? Like in your
distance, like cosine hyperbolic is sine hyperbolic.
Sorry.
When you differentiate a cos twice, you get a minus sign, right?
So you get minus and then plus. Yes. Did I lose a minus sign somewhere?
In your wave equation, I think. Mm-hmm. Your minus sign.
You mean that here there should be a
no,
plus?
No, it's board. Equation of motion should have a minus sign on the m squared.
So I'm just taking this guy and substituting mn.
Yes, c squared equals minus m squared.
Minus m squared.
That's possible. And then you say in this case I get a plus here, a minus here, and that will solve the date. Thank you. Great, you are more awake than me. Okay, so it's a linear combination of sinus and cosinus. And we have two unknowns, which is these guys here, but those we are going to obtain through imposing boundary conditions. So let's do an example. The example is to assume plus plus boundary conditions. What I mean by that is that in the z equals 0, I'm going to impose plus, and then z equals l, I'm going to impose plus boundary conditions too. So imposing in z equals 0 plus boundary conditions leads to the condition that a is equal to 0 check it because obviously I'm not awake. Okay? And then you end up with an equation that just depends on the sinus and not the cosinus. But you get rid of this term. And then B is going to be obtained so once you set this to zero, there is only one term, and then B is fixed by the conditions of orthogonality and the normalization. So what do? With the other boundary conditions at z equals L, which if we say is L, then we end up with Mn in n pi over L, where n is equal 0, 1, 2, and so on. So that's it. We have done this for flat space. We have neglected the potential, which may contain quadratic terms in the fields. And those quadratic terms will appear in the equation of motion. So it is not the most general case by far, but the results, even if you go to word spaces and other potential, the results are very similar. You are going to find a quantization condition for your masses. So the masses in the extra dimension cannot be any value. They had to be some. Sometimes it's not an integer number. Instead of an integer, it's some zeros of Bessel functions or more complicated stuff. But then well, it remains in whatever metric is that the masses are not going to be continuous, but they are going to be some discrete values. And
question?
Yes.
Why do you get n equals 0, 1, 2, and not negative?
So we want to define our, we have defined already our mass. Our n is goes from 0 to infinity. That's our Kaluza-Klein expansion. And also we are defining our masses as positive. Okay. And I think you are doing something in the tutorial.
Yesterday.
You did it already?
Yeah.
Okay. So no, all this. Okay, good.
Well, I think we did parts of it.
Okay. I guess then, since you have done this already, the only thing I want to tell you is that this is the general procedure. It becomes more complicated in Randall-Sundum, for example, in warp extra dimensions. But at the end of the day, the results are very similar. So if you do it in flat space, you understand a lot of what's going on in extra dimensions. OK. Any more questions? So I told you that this theory of extra dimensions is interesting as an effective theory, but also my effective Lagrangian has to recover four dimensions at low energies. So there must be a limit in my expansion where I recover four dimensions and no effect of the extra dimension. Obviously, my Kaluza-Klein or KK decomposition I'm saying that my field that depends on four dimensions and the extra dimension is an infinite sum from n equals 0 to infinity or phi n and epi phi, right? So what it must happen is that at low energies, this expansion of my field in terms of an infinite number of excitations, of KK excitations, I must be able to truncate it at low energies and only keep the zero mode, the lowest mode. So this guy is a sum over many, many modes. And I'm saying that my theory at low energies must look as my five-dimensional field is just the contribution of the zero mode. So we still have this dependence in the profile in the extra dimension. What do I do with it? Well, so as I told you, the action goes as the integral before x, integral over the extra dimension of my Lagrangian, in this case, in five dimensions. So it's a Lagrangian that depends on my field in five dimensions. And what I'm saying is that inside this Lagrangian, I have a bunch of terms. I have an infinite sum, but I'm going to truncate to the first. Yes, Diva.
So, sorry, I was just going back.
Yes.
There's a question in yesterday's tutorial about how the boundary conditions affect the massless mode.
Yes.
And here, if we had the boundary condition which resulted in the cosine term, so
yes,
boundary,
would they have.
Then we would eliminate the
yes.
mass.
So any condition that is minus, minus, plus, minus, or minus, plus, anybody with a minus doesn't
right.
lead to a zero mode.
Right.
The only guy that has a zero mode is the plus plus.
Right.
And that is the same in Randall syndrome, by
right.
the way.
And so the effect of the Randall syndrome is the work factor.
Yes.
Which just kind of stretches out this cosine and makes it to Bessel or something like that.
Exactly.
It's infrared.
Instead of being a very nice sinus or cosinus, like a field that kind of has a support everywhere in the extra dimension, it stretches towards one of the brains.
Right.
We're going to see that, yeah. And that makes the phenomenology much more interesting. So let's go back to this guy. We have our action. Now you know for the scalar field what the action in 5D is. And now we are saying we are going to write down an effective theory. So I want to end up with a Lagrangian 4D effective that depends only on the zero mode. That's what I'm looking for. So I take my action, it looks as d for x. Now, sorry. I have dz. And then what I'm going to do is say every time I see one of these fields, I'm going to obtain a, oh, sorry. Some function of phi naught. And then I'm going to get another function. Well, I shouldn't use these words. Ay, ay, what are they? And another function. For the wave function of the zero mode. Okay, so this guy, we can integrate. So we just do this integration over the whole interval from 0 to L. And let's call this is just going to be some number, right? I'm taking a function of the wave function, sorry, of the zero mode and integrating over the interval. I'm going to get some number here. And at the end of the day, I'm going to get some number times d for x and some function of just the zero mode. Something that just keeps the dynamics of the zero mode. So to write the effective four-dimensional action, or to this is the same as what is called dimensional reduction. So dimensional reduction is you do your Kaluza-Klein decomposition, you obtain your wave functions, the f of z, you truncate at the leading order, integrate the part that corresponds to the wave function, and then you end up with an action that just depends on fluctuations of your four-dimensional field. This is dimensional reduction. By the way, this is something that is equivalent of the stuff we do in finite temperature physics. In finite temperature, you do a dimensional reduction from four dimensions to three dimensions, because what you do is to take the time direction and compactify, and then say that this time direction corresponds to the temperature. So the kind of techniques people use for the Kaluza-Klein decomposition in extra dimensions in flat space are also the same techniques that were used before to deal with finite temperature physics. Yes?
But this doesn't generalize to when we have more than one extra dimension.
What we are, yes, you could have.
The analogy
with finite temperature, indeed.
Temperature is
just reducing one dimension. Indeed. Okay. All right. So, this is in general for any kind of extra dimensions. We compactify these extra dimensions and obtain this Kaluza-Klein tower. So your expectation is that you have extra dimensions. Any field living in this extra dimension will look as a Kaluza-Klein tower of massive states from the point of view 4D. So from the four-dimensional point of view, the presence of a field able to propagate in extra dimensions appears as a tower of massive states with the same quantum numbers. So let's say I allow the photon to propagate in extra dimensions. What I will expect to see at colliders is I know the photon is there, but then I will start seeing a massive photon, a guy that behaves, talks, does everything the same as the photon. So it couples to E plus E minus. But now this photon, Kaluza-Klein excitation of the photon, has some mass. It's the mass of my Kaluza-Klein photon goes as 1 over the length of the extra dimension. All right. So that's the generic prediction. Any field being able to propagate in extra dimensions, because these dimensions are compactified, we expect a Kaluza-Klein tower of fields with the same quantum number. So it's a very generic feature of extra dimensions. But now you may start wondering, what is the possible value of L, right? How big or how can L be? Obviously, if I send L to zero, I close the extra dimension, I don't see any effect, I don't care. So I always recover 4D if I send the length or the compactification size of the extra dimension to zero. Then you would say, if L is infinity, if there was really a fifth extra dimension that is infinite, we will see some effects, right? In particular, because gravity lives in all the dimensions, so gravity will propagate in this extra dimension. This extra dimension is big, and we will see some deviations. So from Newton's law. Or in other words, if there was a big extra dimension out there, and for some reason we couldn't see it by eye, we'll still see its effect through, for example, we could take two balls in what is called a tabletop experiment. And then what they do is vary the radius of the separation between these balls and compute where is the potential as a function of the radius. And this potential, as a function of the radius, is also a function of the number of dimensions where gravity propagates. So through tabletop experiments, we know there are no large extra dimensions because in those dimensions, gravity will lose some strength. So what we know for sure is that the size of the extra dimension has to be less or the order of the millimeter. Actually, right now, it's over there 2 micrometers, 200 micrometers. So through direct probing Newton's law, the gravitational attraction between objects, we have access at the size of the extra dimensions. And that leads to some constraints on the size of those extra dimensions. Do we know anything else? Okay, so these are big, they're macroscopic balls, right? But we also checked electroweak interactions, strong interactions. We understand the standard model up to the TeV scale. So you know how big is the TeV scale? What do you do when you want to translate from energies to distances?
You use h bar c for 197 MeV.
And then you set it to 1, and then you get a relation. Very good. Yeah. There you go. We are talking natural units. H bar c is of order 0.2 GeV per Fermi. We are saying that we understand or we see the standard model in 4 dimensions up to the TeV scale. We don't see the effect of these extra dimensions. We haven't seen any Kaluza-Klein particle. When we check the QED or the anomalous magnetic moment of the electron, seems to work very well for quantum field theory in 4 dimensions. So it doesn't seem, at least for the standard model particles, can live inside extra dimensions that are bigger or of order 1 over the TeV scale, which is much, much smaller than the millimeter. So what Arkani, Hamed, Dimopoulos, and Valli came out in 98 is to say, or this is called the ABD, is to say, well, studying string theory, one of the revolutions of string theory was precisely to talk about brains. Brains are topological singularities where you can trap matter. So they say maybe the standard model lives in a brain, and this brain is 4-dimensional, but maybe our universe, or the it's actually D-dimensional. We just don't see it because our standard model is stuck to live in a 4-dimensional submanifold or this D-dimensional universe. What we know for sure is that no matter what construction you do for your extra dimensions, this extra dimension should be kind of below the millimeter scale. That's a constraint. But a millimeter is a huge size, right? We're talking about the presence of extra dimensions that are order millimeter. I couldn't even look at myself. So that was called, the ADD is called also the large extra dimensions, or LED scenario. So that's their setup. That was in 98. And that initiated at least in model building, the revolution of extra dimensions. nobody had thought of extra dimensions before. Well, not many people thought about extra dimensions as anything useful for phenomenology before, right? These are these things that string theories do, why do we care? But this opened the possibility of putting together this conflicting data. Extra dimensions could be huge, but be not in the standard model that they, at least the standard model particles cannot live inside an extra dimension bigger than this. So that's much as well. Okay, so that was LED. Excellent. If you look at the citations, it's probably 4,000 citations already. I mean, pretty popular proposal. They wrote a very long paper discussing all kinds of constraints on extra dimensions, large extra dimensions. It was very exciting because one of the unavoidable consequences of this is that you are going to end up producing black holes. And that's kind of very cool. Okay. The status nowadays is that people don't care so much about LED anymore. Stories like universal extra dimensions that we are going to talk about, UED, and mostly Randall Sundrum models are the state of the art these days. LED are kind of weird and quirky in the sense that, how to say, they lead to these very spectacular signatures. People will go and look in more detail. They are not there, so it's getting more and more contrived, whereas you will see how Randall Sundrum is a reasonable approach to extra dimensions. A little bit of warping, you get Randall Sundrum, and then the phenomenology changes completely. In Randall Sundrum, standard model particles can live in the bulk of the extra dimension, and that makes their phenomenology much more interesting. They are not stuck to live on a brain. So let me tell you first why large extra dimensions are not so exciting as a solution for the hierarchy problem. So the picture is we have some four-dimensional brain. The standard model, we are stuck there. But there are n extra dimensions, and gravity propagates in all of them. So if we look at the gravitational action, this goes as integral d4x, of the four dimensions, integral dnz. We put the metric here, let me write little g, and the Ricci scalar. And then I know that this guy has to go as M Planck, and I know what number to put here in four dimensions, but we are going to deduce what number appears here in four plus N dimensions. Yes, Andrew, you have a question? Okay. So we do dimensional analysis as usual. This is minus 4 plus n. G, what are the dimensions of the metric?
2.
What is the metric? It's a matrix and by d plus.
It depends on how you interpret it. Because if you say that ds squared is equal to 2, then you have g mu nu, ds mu, dx nu, and dx mu, dx nu can be angles. So we could say that g mu nu could have.
In any so we want mass dimensions of this guy, right? I agree. You can always reshuffle. For example, if you use your variables as being angles, then your metric seems to receive some dimensions, but it's not true, right? It's a radius or something else. So in general, your metric is not a dynamical object. It's just a guy with numbers, so it has no dimensions of mass. What is the Ricci scalar? This guy essentially is a gamma-gamma contracted, and this guy is essentially derivatives of the metric. So the Ricci scalar has dimensions of 2.
Do they have a person then?
Yes, yes.
say we look at the metric in some radial coordinates, and I mean it has r squared sin squared theta in it.
Yes.
And r squared, you're saying that it doesn't have any dimension.
So I'm saying that.
Or does theta have?
So if you just look at this, it looks like G minu doesn't have dimensions. What you're saying is that then I can get things like this with a guy in front. And it looks like this is my metric, right? But it is not my metric. This is dx, dx in radial coordinates. So the number in front is the, what you would call the metric. This is. Okay, so the volume, we know what the units are. Metric doesn't have units. The Ricci, because it's a second derivative of the metric, gets units of 2. And then we just balance the units here and check this because I need more coffee. I think you just get m plus 2. So with 0 extra dimensions, you get your usual n Planck square. But if you have n extra dimensions, you get extra powers here. So notice that I'm writing the gravitational interaction, the gravitational action, in my d-dimensional space. So this M Planck is the fundamental, M Planck is the fundamental Planck scale. This is really the way the graviton couples to matter and to other fields. This is really the strength of the gravitational interaction. Okay. So let's say that these n extra dimensions, these guys, are compactified. So we follow similar steps as here, and we end up with, if we look at distances r that are much smaller than the radius of the compactification, not much bigger, than the radius of the compactification. So we are going to compactify these n dimensions with radius r. And we are going to look at the action for big, large distances. Okay, so that looks as I'm going to get M Planck, M plus 2. If I'm assuming flat extra dimensions, this plays no role. I can just integrate this guy. And I'm going to get something that goes as r to the power of n. And then some d4x, the Ricci scalar in four dimensions, and that's the end of it. So this is precisely what we were doing before. This is dimensionally reducing this action. So we take the action in n plus four dimensions. We assume that we look at large distances where we don't see the dynamics of these extra dimensions. But we want to see what is the effect of integrating now those extra dimensions, that is dimensional reduction. I get the four-dimensional action. And now the term that appears in front, instead of being M Planck square, is the fundamental M Planck to M plus 2. And now we have a volume factor from the extra dimensions. So as a four-dimensional observer, as a guy living here, I see this action, and I interpret that the strength of gravitational interactions, let me call it just like this, is exactly this factor here. All right. So that's my interpretation. I see gravitational dynamics as having a Planck scale in front, but this Planck scale is not the fundamental Planck scale. It is a function of the fundamental plane scale and the volume of the extra dimension. So let's put some numbers. We are saying, well, this is the relation, and we are saying that if R to the n, which is the volume of the n extra dimensions, is large, then the fundamental Planck scale and the scale of Planck that we see from four dimensions may be very different from each other. So ADD say that, wow, wouldn't it be cool if we had this fundamental Planck scale to be order TB? That would solve the hierarchy problem. There are no fundamental scales beyond TB. It's just that we are fooling ourselves thinking that the Planck scale is much, much bigger, but it's because this volume factor. So then they say, well, if I set this to be TV, then for n equals 1, I get that the radius is of order 10 to the 13 centimeters. So it's as big as the solar system, essentially. That's not good. So they say, well, let's go to n equals 2, two extra dimensions. Then the radius can be of order millimeter. So they interpreted, they solved the hierarchy problem in a very cute way, saying there is no hierarchy problem. The reason why gravity is so weak as compared with the other forces of the standard model is because gravity is as strong as the standard model forces. What happens is that gravity has to share its support with inside other extra dimensions. So that what we see from our limited vision of the world in our brain is a diluted effect. The dilution of gravitational interactions inside these extra dimensions is given by this volume factor. So if I make these extra dimensions to be big, this volume to be big, then I can be, with a theory that fundamentally is TeV, looking as a theory with a much higher mass. So the weakness of gravity is just an effect of gravity having to share its strength with other dimensions. So that's cool. That's a good way of rephrasing the hierarchy problem. There is no hierarchy problem. It leads to interesting phenomenology and super cool science fiction. But do you see anything wrong in all this? I am rephrasing the problem of why. Now I'm saying that this guy is of order TeV, whereas in Planck, the one I see is of order 10 to the 18 GeVs. Before, I was saying that these two guys are so different, I have a hierarchy problem. Now I'm saying that all this effect is given by this volume. So I am reshuffling the problem of the hierarchy between, what is the hierarchy? It's TeV over M Planck. We don't understand why they are so widely separated. I'm reshuffling this problem into the problem one, why there are large extra dimensions. Why the radius of this guy happens to be such that I get this kind of wide separation between scales. And worse than that is, how do I make this radius to stay the way it is? The stabilization of these extra dimensions is very hard, right? So on one hand, it's cool because at least you are shifting focus of the problem of the hierarchy problem, leading to new phenomenology. On the other hand, you are actually reshuffling the problem into the presence of these particular dimensions, of these particular sets being large. And also, you are introducing a new problem, which is how do I stabilize those dimensions? And this is a not a simple question, relative Reynolds. So, cool, but that was a lot of excitement, as you can imagine, because I mean, having access to star dimensions is kind of a super cool idea. But as this proposal, I think, has lost some strength among the community. Okay, so let me tell you what are the consequences, roughly what are the consequences of having these large star dimensions. So, large star dimensions. Standard model lives on a brain. The universe is actually three-dimensional. What do you think we are going to see at colliders and the LHC? Our machine for the moment, maybe the last.
I mean, if energies are good enough, then we can probe the star dimensions.
If, okay, so we can maybe probe the star dimensions. How do we do that?
If the energy is big enough, that the size and then the size here corresponds to the energy is smaller than the size of the extra dimension.
Yeah, these guys are considering an extra dimension that is millimeter. That is pretty large. Whereas the interactions, the usual interactions in the standard model are 1 over TeV. So you are thinking of maybe opening the extra dimension and looking inside?
I mean, we can do that, but they can. I mean, they get.
Yes.
To this distance, the gravitational interaction is going to be relevant.
Yes, but since I completely agree, but because these guys are precisely talking about large star dimensions, this is orders of magnitude bigger than what the Large Hadron Collider does. Right? So actually, large star dimensions, seeing the size, is something that the tabletop experiments are doing. But we can do things at colliders. What do you think we are going to see?
Yes. So, you're doing TeV scale experiments, right? So, and that's a quantum gravity scale?
Exactly. So we are opening all the Pandora box or the quantum gravity effects. If you believe in string theory, you will start seeing winding modes, black holes, who knows what we have no clue. But it's cool. Okay. So that's one possibility. What else?
So if the scale was really low,
if the scale,
if the energy scale was, if the extra dimensions were really low,
yes,
wouldn't that make problems for the black holes to get really too big to evaporate before they hit the wall of the collider?
So you're saying that the black holes could extend into the extra dimension. So I produce a black hole, extends into the extra dimension, and then I don't see the evaporation.
Yeah, what I mean is that it wouldn't manage to evaporate before it would accumulate more matter. That would be also a possibility.
So the problem with black... You are going to do a homework about this. Your homework is about black holes. So you are going to read, for example, the... So you knew that the people... There were a couple of guys that sued LHC because of that. And then the theorists took it very seriously and decided to write a report showing why black holes, if they are formed at the LHC, will evaporate. One of the sources is to say of information is to say that the LHC is not the first time we reach TeV scales, right? Like this happens all the time in cosmic rays. And you know, the Earth has been around for a long time. We know that for sure. So you can estimate what is the probability that if you form a black hole, it doesn't evaporate. Right? So you are going to read all these things for your homework. And I don't know what I wanted to tell. Yes, so it could be, it is an open question. We have never seen Hawking radiation, right? Just because if you look at the black holes, and for example, in the center of our galaxy, and estimate what is the temperature of Hawking radiation, is below the CMB. So you need to increase the way you are measuring the CMB fluctuations by orders of magnitude to be able to see any Hawking radiation from the black hole in the center of the galaxy level. So the only possibility will be to produce, to see Hawking radiation, to produce this kind of small black holes that radiate at temperatures we can actually measure. We haven't seen that. We haven't seen the Hawking radiation in the black hole, the real black holes. So we don't know if Hawking is red. It could be that black holes do not radiate. It could be that black holes are formed and they stay there, are stable. And what you're saying is that it could be, if they are stable, what you will think is that the black hole will just accrete more and more matter and will go to the highest density part of the Earth, it will go to the center, start accreting, it will destroy the Earth, the universe, and eventually, you know, will be cool, but it's going to happen. So what this report you are going to read says is that either there are no TV black holes, or if they are, then they evaporate. So it's true that having the size of the external dimension and the way it's compactified changes the way the black hole radiates. And those are accounted by gray factors, for example. It is true. Yes?
So if black holes are of TV scale, then you'll have to deal with the black hole information paradox, right?
Yeah. It's going to be fun. Yeah. It's crazy, but before understanding gauge theories, I'm sure everybody thought it was a crazy idea, and this is the way it goes. It could be that black holes are at the TV scale, who knows? For these people, the fact that the electroweak scale is so small, and the fact that gravitational interactions are so weak, is for them meant is an indication that there is TV scale gravity. So, as a consequence, you get black holes. Another thing you will expect is that, so here we are in our four-dimensional world. Here we have the LHC, protons colliding. It could be that they produce particles that escape into the extra dimensions. So you collide two protons, and when you look at the energy balance, it seems that there is some missing energy. So what you would expect is missing energy signatures from, for example, gravitons getting into the extra dimension. This is written like this, missing transverse energy. Okay.
Veronica?
Yes.
How would that MET signature look different from like a neutrino or like an LSB?
Yes. So why do we see missing so neutrinos and LSPs? We discussed the other day. The neutrinos are massless. So when you look at the distribution of missing energy, they are compatible with a massless particle. And also neutrinos come from known sources in the standard model. They come because the W decays. So you can look at the transverse distribution and maybe see that it corresponds to the W mass. Then the LSPs. It's a massive particle. But I guess the main difference between supersymmetry and these guys is that in supersymmetry, you know that finding missing energy signatures, having a stable LSP, is because there is an R parity. And because there is an R parity, you always pair produce supersymmetric particles. So you are going to see these signatures that are typical of pair production. Whereas this guy is just two protons, woo, graviton, disappear. But I agree, they can be impostors of each other. You have to look into it. Okay, cool. So missing energy signatures, collisions at the TV scale may be able to probe black holes, and you are going to do a homework about it. You are going to do a homework about it because it's kind of fun and it's simple enough. It's just counting, so why not? It's much simpler than doing a real computation of a cross section. Okay, so that's for large star dimensions. Maybe today I can even finish in time. What we are going to do tomorrow is something that is actually used nowadays. Something that people are using thoroughly in model building, I search at the Large Hadron Collider as well. Those are called worth extra dimensions. Oops. The most popular proposal of warping is Randall Sundrum model, which is a model in anti-de Sitter space. Let me just tell you one line. What is the solution of the hierarchy problem in Randall Sundrum? Randall Sundrum says that the fundamental Planck mass, the Planck mass you see in 4D are the same, 10 to the 10 GeV. So it looks like it's not solving anything, right? It's not doing anything. It's saying that the Planck mass you see in 5 dimensions, the Planck mass you see in 4 dimensions are actually of the same order. What they do is to introduce a curvature. It's a curve of space-time, it's highly curved actually, and that's why it's called warped. And they say, I'm going to introduce a curvature, this is a dimension full quantity, and this is going to be of the same order of M Planck, and four-dimensional M Planck. So at this level, this looks like what they are doing is introducing a curvature that is natural in the sense that it's the same order of any other fundamental parameter in my theory. And then, so how is the TV scale coming on? Well, then they say, I introduce the curvature, and I am also going to introduce the length of the extra dimension. It's going to be the same order as well. The way the Randall Sundrum solves the hierarchy problem is by redshifting.
Question? Mm-hmm. So the curvature dimension to the length.
So, yeah, so you compute the Ricci tensor, goes as k is pi.
Okay.
Yes. So what they do is to say that the M Planck is redshifted to the TeV scale, red or blue shifted, one of them is shifted, just because of the effect of the curvature. So we think we see TeV scale, but actually TeV scale is actually M Planck. The way it works is through this redshifting. It's the same as gravitational redshifting, and it has to do with the strong curvature in the extra dimension. So you are going to see it's funny, but it's to start with a theory with all where all the scales are the same order, and end up with a theory with one derived scale is order TeV. So the solution of the hierarchy problem in Randall Sundrum is radically different from what the large extra dimensions people are talking about. And the phenomenology is richer and also more common, so you don't expect a lot of black holes at the LHC. Maybe we will never see black holes in Randall Sundrum, and also with RS, you can solve issues like the fermion hierarchy problem and the neutrino masses or a bunch of stuff. So it opens lots of possibilities for modeling. So I'll show you tomorrow how this works.